This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about the challenges and opportunities facing the Central Coast event planning community.
Here, I mean, events are still going on, and it's just there's no regulation, so it's kind of wild, wild west, and that's a lot more dangerous.
Also, there's a Santa Barbara County nonprofit called YouthWell, which provides free mental health workshops for teens, parents, and educators.
Communities like ours that are just amazing communities. I mean, beautiful areas to live, a lot of wonderful resources, but it doesn't mean we're immune from these same issues.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 21st, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Founded in 1958, the Monterey Jazz Festival usually takes place at the Monterey County Fairgrounds on the third weekend in September. That's when hundreds of the world's top jazz musicians play for thousands of attendees over the three-day festival. But like many public events this year, the 63rd annual iteration of the renowned festival will be virtual. KAZU's Michelle Loxton has more.
For the first time in its history, the Monterey Jazz Festival will be completely virtual this year. It won't be live, but it will be appointment viewing. Meaning, from September 25th, for 3 days, you'll have to be in front of a screen between 5 and 7 p.m. if you want to catch performances like this one.
I remember night as if it were yesterday.
We've watched her grow up. You know, musically.
I can hear my friends.
That's the festival's artistic director, Tim Jackson, talking about Diane Reeves and one of her archival pieces they've chosen to feature this year.
I think she's the finest jazz vocalist working right now. And this was a tune from 2015, which is a very fun and speaks to Diane's very whimsical side to her, and it's a tune entitled Nine.
The festival had 63 years worth of archival audio and video to choose from for this year's program. But there will also be new content, like this piece from the festival's artist-in-residence, Christian Sands.
Great young artist, fantastic pianist, fantastic composer, band leader, arranger. Interestingly enough, Christian Bean, I think probably just barely 30 years old, picked a tune from a British rock band called Blind Faith from the late 60s, and it's a great composition called Can't Find My Way Home.
This year will also feature a special archival performance that was recorded a few years ago, but features a very specific Quincy Jones era, the late 60s to early 70s.
And we were able to put together a fantastic big band to revisit about 8 of these charts from that era. This track, Killer Joe, which is a great Benny Golson composition, and it's really kind of epitomizes the classic Quincy sound from that era.
This year's performance by the festival's Next Generation Jazz Orchestra is a feat in itself. The band performs together all remotely.
So it's students from throughout the country, some of the best young jazz musicians.
I never cared much for moonlit skies. I never winked back at fireflies.
And it combines so many elements of jazz history. It's a Quincy Jones arrangement. It's a Duke Ellington composition. It is Ella Fitzgerald who was singing on the original chart, and the original chart was played by the Count Basie Band.
The orchestra was directed by Gerald Clayton, who's been coming to the Monterey Jazz Festival since he was part of the high school jazz band competition. Over the years, he's come back many times as an artist.
I do feel in a lot of ways like I'm the same kid I was when I first, you know, got on those fairgrounds. So hopefully can kind of give them some hints and clues and expose them to some things that will help them along their journey.
The Gerald Clayton Quartet will also perform a number of tunes, including this one by Thelonious Monk entitled Evidence.
The theme is very much in the spirit of the music, which is improvisation, just, you know, not overly planned necessarily. We just got together and chose a couple tunes and didn't have a rehearsal, just counted them off, and, you know, you see what you get.
You can view the festival for free this year, but they'll be raising money over the 3 days, with that being split between the artists, the NAACP Defense Fund, and the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. The festival says this is part of recognizing that jazz comes from the heart of Black culture and wanting to serve as a platform for artists to share social justice messages. For Gerald Clayton, we are living in a societal awakening right now.
As uncomfortable as it may be for some people to take a hard look at some of those harsh truths and facts of our history, I think it's also really important. Wayne Shorter says, you know, you use the tools from the past as a flashlight into the darkness of the future. Quincy Jones says, you know, you got to know where you came from to know where you're going. I'm always trying to further explore my roots, whether it's, you know, the actual language of the music or the circumstances that surrounded the music.
In Monterey, I'm Michelle Loxton, KEZU.
Working Lunch is a Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, you'll hear from Bo and Melissa Kramer of Kramer Events.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber of Commerce. And today, you'll get to be a part of the conversation with Bo and Melissa Kramer of Kramer Events. This is Working Lunch. It's the SLO Chamber's weekly series where we sit down with our community leaders and give you the chance to feel that connection to your community that we may have been missing during these challenging times. You know, if you've attended an event in the SLO region in the PC era, that's pre-COVID, not politically correct, you've probably been attended to by Kramer Events. Starting as a one-man operation at Cal Poly in 1997, Kramer Events has grown to one of the largest event production companies on the Central Coast. In the PC time, their team of 30 was providing everything from DJs, lighting, and photo booths to event coordination and entertainment for over 200 weddings and events each year. Melissa, Bo, thank you so much for being here.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
Where are you zooming in from today, and what was for lunch?
Well, we're zooming in from our house in San Luis Obispo. We are fitting this in, and we really appreciate being here in between being teachers, teaching our school during this whole virtual learning wonderfulness these days. Our kids are elementary school age, first and fourth, so I'm back and forth between them. And
we bribe the kids for a half hour. They get digital devices. And
yep.
They're loving it.
We're in our guest room right now, but...
Well, it's funny because that is the new kind of normal, right? That we end up with the having to zoom in from a room where we can kind of scratch out a little time, and especially where we're being teachers along with having to do our jobs. Kind of start from the beginning. You know, what initially drew you to the events industry?
So I started back in my dorm room with two turntables underneath my dorm room bed and a microphone. Which is funny because there was a song out about that, and two turntables and a microphone. So And so just was jamming parties there at Cal Poly. And I think I did my first event for $50 in beer. From there, learned how to do weddings and realized really quickly that at an event, a lot of the professionals were siloed. Like, okay, this is my thing. I'm going to DJ. That's it. Or I'm going to do photography and that's it. Or I'm going to do videography and that's it. And I realized at that time, there wasn't a lot of collaboration. And I had a different philosophy about how it's almost military. Like you help the person to your right or left, in our case, vendors, and the whole event goes better. So my philosophy has always been come prepared, get our role done, but be so prepared that you have all this extra time to help everyone else, because usually the vision of the event extends way beyond what you're actually working on. And so that philosophy is like how we started Kramer Events.
How did you guys meet, and when did the two of you start working together on this?
Well, I like to say I came home from work one day when in the 3 months I actually had a different job selling cell phones, and she was on my couch when I got home from work, and it was
he had it easy. We say the dating stork brought me. This was back in 2002, and my girlfriend and I came down to San Luis Obispo, and I had some friends, and my friend had roommates, and one of his roommates was Beau. It's even more of a small world. Come to find out, his mother was my 7th grade art teacher. He grew up in the same area I did, but we didn't know each other. And, you know, we got married in 2006. I came in the mix, no pun intended, with Kramer Event in 2008. The economy went to hell in a handbasket, but my husband wanted to grow a company, and he said, I need a salesperson. And I said, okay, fingers crossed. And we haven't looked back. So here we are.
You've already been through one, what probably would have felt like the worst financial time ever. Was any of that helpful in terms of where you kind of see your business today in terms of how you're getting through this?
Yeah, you're talking like in 2008 when the recession compared to now. We had like low overhead back then, and we were just emerging in the market. And so for us, we didn't really have a huge rent or any payroll to really bog us down. So it was kind of a good point for us to grow, you know, strategically back then. That was our highest growth time. We were aggressive with advertising. And so for us, it was a good thing. And, you know, parlaying that to now, I think some of those elements come back around. Like now we're bigger, right? So now we really have to have the overhead conversation. How do we really tighten the belt so that we can thrive in this situation?
You're hitting onto a great spot here. So almost no one has been completely spared in the pandemic, but obviously the events industry has been hit maybe the hardest. Can you give us a feel of the scale of the local impact right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty devastating. It's the biggest blow we've ever had as an industry, having a pandemic and not being able to hang out together, you know, on a large format. It makes it difficult to do almost all the services that the industry has to offer. You know, some people are pivoting in different ways, but it's devastating. And I think it's a real big morale bust for our whole industry. And it's difficult for everyone to stay positive right now. There's a lot of financial duress right now. I've got friends that have already declared bankruptcy or in stages of bankruptcy or selling their business for pennies on the dollar. Everyone's kind of got a date in their head that owns a event industry business, and it's their death date. Everyone knows how long they can bleed for until we need to have the economy back or their business can't survive.
And that sounds kind of harsh, but there's no exaggeration there. We have friends and mentors all over the country and in a lot bigger cities than us. You know, just having to deal with clients that are not so understanding and then having lawsuits pressed on them and go on and on and on. But it's really sad and disheartening. And these are people that we look up to as mentors. They're so successful in their business. And back to like our local industry community, it's been really hard there because it's a tight-knit family. We call them frienders instead of vendors. And it's been hard. And we normally right now, like we're in the peak of our season. We know it'll get back to normal one day, but it's going to look a little bit different.
There's usually specific guidelines of what to be targeting when things are coming online. That doesn't seem to be the case for the private events industry.
That's the case. I believe there's guidance for dog walkers and most other industries, but the governor's decided not to give us any real guidance with weddings or wedding receptions or events on any level. It's interesting, though, the other 49 states, their governors have allowed wedding receptions and have given them guidance on how they can safely do events, and ours has chosen not to.
You guys are an inherently creative industry, so it does seem that maybe the lack of guidance could unintentionally create more risk where people are going to try and figure out how to do those things anyways.
It's kind of back in the prohibition days, you know what I mean? It didn't work for alcohol. It didn't work for marijuana. What they're finding the other states is because they're legalizing it and allowing it, they can control it and they can have regulations. And it's actually really easy to make a wedding safe. You can have contact tracing right when you come in the door. You can even test, quick tests. You can socially distance. I mean, if you want to control it, you can make that thing safer than going down to a restaurant to eat. And other states have found that out and they're doing it and having a lot of success with that. But not having that here, I mean, events are still going on and it's just, there's no regulation. So it's kind of wild, wild west. And that's a lot more dangerous. The events that are on the news, you know, across the country, the ones where they're not following protocol, they don't have any safety measures, it's not professionally run. Those are the ones we're all seeing on the news, you know, saying that the event industry is irresponsible.
We feel if a restaurant can turn over a table and be outdoors 3 or 4 times in a 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. time frame with different people each time, why can't that happen at a wedding reception? And of course, there's more to it than that, but there's a lot of contradiction.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between the Slo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona and Bo and Melissa Kramer of Kramer Events.
So the California Association for Private Events is a California-based coalition getting off the ground, and they are advocating to safely reopen California and asking for guidance from Governor Newsom. Additionally, a few colleagues of mine and event leaders from around this area have started the San Luis Obispo Event Coalition. There's a lack of communication and understanding about how to get through this together. There's a lot of, lack of a better word, hopelessness and frustration, fear, anxiety. And so we just need to come together. And we're trying to have that as a vehicle for us to just exchange information about what's going on. And also, again, advocate to Newsom to consider reopening as the other states have done.
This is why I thought this conversation was so important for us to have so that we can go talk to government about it. I just feel sorry that you have to go to that level. I think that follows some of the issues that you saw on the nail salons and stuff. Well, all of a sudden they opened up, even though not much had really changed. You know, seeing this challenge, has it done anything for you in considering your business model, how you do business?
Yeah, I would say when COVID first hit, it was just like, whoa, do we go to Costco and hoard a bunch of toilet paper? Or same thoughts everyone experienced. And, you know, maybe a month goes by, we're like, all right, things are not letting up. So we need to trim the fat. What is our passion? Where is our heart? Why are we in this? You know, and then anything else that doesn't fall within that realm, we have to let that go. So we reorganized our office. We sold equipment that was maybe used once a year for that one client that we said, oh, we'll make money hand over fist over this, but just sits on the shelf. It was pretty eye-opening to see how much of that we got rid of. And it was just freeing. It was a great distraction too. So here we are, September, and we're still trying to be proactive and work on the business right now, and because we have the time. Again, normally this is our crazy, I call it psycho season, and it's the complete opposite now.
To piggyback off, Melissa, we decided, like, what doesn't bring us joy? Okay, wow, well, you take a look at your business or your situation, your life, and like, I don't really enjoy doing that, but I was kind of just doing that over and over again. Why? You know, but this is so much more fun. Let's do more of that and less of this. And we did a lot of that in our company. And we're excited because essentially us and every other person in the event industry has the opportunity to just restart their business exactly the way they want it. And that's really exciting because it's like, God, we could just re-engineer it all over again and do exactly what we want to do, the things we've always wanted to do. And, you know, obviously we have other issues and challenges to figure out, but like that part is very exciting. And that part is something that's the reason why we go to work right now.
We were given an opportunity to hit reset and set a new standard and a new norm. It feels so good. It just feels good that we're trying to always keep that kind of outlook on this. I mean, don't get me wrong. We have our days where I'm just like, oh, you know, whether it's with the kids or just ash falling from the sky, you know, Armageddon, you know, like, what is happening? K-2020, you can exit stage left. We are done.
there's a term I heard recently from a colleague that said the event industry is not coming back. it's going forward. So it'll look different, it'll be different in the future, but it'll be what you want to make out of it.
I can really appreciate that, you know, you run a business and you're just head down, got to just keep charging forward. The ability to reset some of it is, that's a fabulous way to use this time. Hopefully we'll be getting to a point soon where you get back to implement those things. I heard you also say something about the Slow Event Coalition. I would assume you are all competitors. Has that changed in that you have found that commonality?
I've changed my thinking a lot more. I used to be more of a finite mindset where, okay, we've got to go accomplish these things. I'm chatting with my direct competitors at least once or twice a week, just helping them. They're helping me. I mean, we're kind of doing things together, sharing resources, documents, and that's been really cool. So like relationships that I haven't really talked to in a while, we're really starting to collaborate more. And I'm seeing other people in our industry start to do the same. That could be a great thing coming out of this. It's just the need to get through this together. I think we'll pull a lot of people together. And I think my hope is that our industry will be shifted in a much more collaborative. It already was, but I think it's going to go to the next level with collaboration.
I mean, I can't tell you how many text messages I sent or I received, especially in the beginning when the people who like are in the sales seat with their job in the industry, like they're booking the clients, handling the contracts. So, you know, when this hit, all the postponements or the cancellations for the weddings and events came in, and I can't tell you how many times I would text my friend April over at The Rock, Slippery Rock. I'm like, how are you handling this? What do you say? And then vice versa. And I've had other vendors do that with me. Like, Melissa, how did you handle this? Are you giving refunds? We all need each other. We still do. I mean, it's not over. And we're still dealing with postponements. And, you know, going into next year, you know, our peak dates are pretty much booked up. So we're really, you know, I feel bad for our incoming newly engaged couples, because I'm like, hey guys, you got to really get on the ball now. Let's book now. We still have a few openings, or consider a non-Saturday, like a Friday or Sunday. I'll hook you up.
Which I think are better. Fridays and Sundays.
Wrong. Yeah, but you know, I mean, it's very much collaborative. It's an even playing field.
Are there some events that are going forward?
There's a few. I mean, there's some private dinners that we're helping out on. There's a few things here and there. It's kind of on pause. I mean, I'd say we're about 10%. Normal operation until we get some guidance one way or another. I mean, we've got a stack of companies that are wanting to celebrate with their teams and throw year-end parties, and they're kind of waiting to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
We've tweaked our services, so we have all these touchless options now and socially distanced options, which is rad, but I think they're just waiting for the go-ahead from governor first, right, and then venues to be able to host them. So changes day by day. You know, we're hopeful to be able to start reemerging some of our services again out in the community, you know, as we get to the next stage of things.
Is there something that with all of these changes and stuff that you think maybe personally or professionally you're going to hope, you know, taken out of this that you hope will be permanent?
So like for me, it's, you could legitimately say the sky is falling, right? And wake up every day and start your day saying that. Or you can say, wow, despite the sky is falling, like, what are the cool things around me? And you can kind of trick your brain into being positive and look at life that way. And all of a sudden, these opportunities that you wouldn't have seen are emerging because your mind is in that place. So I think the most important thing for me is just focusing on staying positive, and you'll find that those positive outcomes will find you.
We're big Hamilton fans, and I think of the song, look around, we're so lucky to be alive right now. You know, I literally sing that song in my head. So I just kind of, that's my little internal song. And, you know, look on the bright side. I mean, we have our health, we have our roof over our heads. We're still booking events for next year, you know, and into 2022. So that's good. That's the cool thing about the event industry. Like, we get something called booking fees and initial payments, and it's like, yes. and thinking outside the box. And again, this is your reset button. Do what you want, not what you have to do.
Yes. And you touched my soul there with a little Broadway singing. But
okay.
Melissa, Bo, thank you so much for being here.
That was Bo and Melissa Kramer of Kramer Events speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. The University of California at Berkeley is starting a new center to study the science of psychedelics. KQED's Laura Clivens talked to one of the center's co-founders, journalist and author Michael Pollan, to learn more.
When Paulin told friends he was co-founding a center to study psychedelics at UC Berkeley, he heard the same response a lot.
They always thought Berkeley would be the first place to have a psychedelic study center.
But Berkeley isn't the first. Although psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin have been outlawed nationwide for roughly 50 years, recent studies have shown the drugs, coupled with therapy, are particularly effective in treating some mental health problems. For example, the nonprofit MAPS, based in Santa Cruz, is currently in late-stage human trials on the use of MDMA, or ecstasy, to treat PTSD. Johns Hopkins is studying psilocybin to treat addiction and severe depression. Berkeley Center will instead focus on how psychedelics affect the brain.
The work that isn't getting done in this country to that extent is looking at what psychedelics such as psilocybin have to teach us about the mind, about things like creativity, consciousness, cognition, emotion.
The center will also train people to be guides or facilitators for psychedelic research and therapies. I'm Laura Clivens.
And now more on mental health. Contributor Beth Thornton brings us a segment on Youth Well. It's a nonprofit that provides free mental health workshops and resources for teens, parents, and educators. It's located in Santa Barbara County, but due to the pandemic, programs are now offered virtually, which means families from outside the area can easily join in.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm joined by Rachel Steidel, Executive Director of Youth Well. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Beth. Nice to be here.
Rachel, how did YouthWell come about, and explain the mission of the organization?
So our focus with YouthWell is focusing on education, support, prevention, and early intervention in order to connect youth 10 to 25 and families to mental health and wellness resources. And a huge emphasis is trying to get families to supports before crisis. And one of the motivators for starting this 5 years ago was having had my own personal experience with my daughter, who started struggling with depression when she was in ninth grade.
So you created a coalition of local mental health advocates and providers. Is that right?
So the focus at the time has been Santa Barbara County. And so it was to bring together our providers, our law enforcement, our medical community, parents, youth, and really hear from everybody and find out how we work more in collaboration and less in these siloed environments. One of the things that we have found, and that I think so many of us understand, is that mental health is so stigmatizing and it carries a lot of shame. So whether you are the person experiencing it or it's a family member, so often we kind of go underground when there's a mental health issue where someone breaks an arm. We don't have a problem letting someone know. We don't have a problem asking for help or taking help. One of the things with YouthWell that we have realized that is so important is education. We can't access resources and services quickly enough often because we just don't have enough of them. So when that happens, we can feel really helpless, whether, again, we're the person struggling or we're the person trying to support someone. I really believe that the more that we all educate ourselves to understand mental health and understand what mental health challenges look like, and then learn some of the tools that we can use to both support ourselves and others, can be really empowering.
Tell us where Santa Barbara County falls within the state as far as like the statistics around mental health for youth.
So about a year ago, we were ranked 18th in California for having the highest suicide rates out of 58 counties. And I think SLO is up there as well. And what's amazing is you look at communities like ours that are just amazing communities. I mean, beautiful areas to live, a lot of wonderful resources, but it doesn't mean we're immune from these same issues.
During the pandemic, there have been reports of anxiety and depression going up compared to this time last year. Your organization has been reaching out and providing ways for young people to connect during the pandemic, right, through workshops and that kind of thing. Do you want to tell us about that? And also give us some idea of how many students are feeling like they need this extra support right now.
The quarantine workshops, quarantine in parentheses, T-E-E-N, were started basically after talking to a lot of these students and hearing them talk about feeling disconnected. We designed them so that they could feel more connected to other students and then focus on their mental wellness and then also explore some topics that often they don't have time to do. And we wanted to raise awareness and eliminate the stigma around mental health by just promoting more self-care, connection, kindness. What are some of the things that we can be doing? And the response was amazing. We had 75 to 100 students on every call, and we offered them weekly for 8 weeks. And our very last call, we had our community leaders and, you know, senators, et cetera, getting on the call to talk about COVID too, and talk about what students can both be expecting and how they can be doing things in their own community. We had a college panel. And so we kind of looked at what are the things that we can take advantage of that normally we wouldn't be able to do. So we invited local college students to create a college panel who go to colleges all over the country, but now had time to get on a Zoom call, and then invited high school students to come on and be able to ask them questions about their experiences in college, learn more about what it's like to go to college on the East Coast versus the West Coast, what it's like to be at a small school versus a big school. And then in addition, had some speakers talk about things like how food can affect your moods, why movement's so important in during this time. So again, things that we can all relate to. One thing that's really important, I think, is that when we talk about mental health, often people can pull away thinking, I don't have a mental health issue. I don't have depression. I don't know what that looks like. And it can feel really uncomfortable for people. But if we go into it and we talk about it in a way that people can relate to, more people are willing to step in and listen. And so when we design the workshops, we look at things like, we all have stress at different times. We've all had times to feel sad and have different emotions. And if we look at it from some of those things that we all experience, and then knowing things like exercise and food and how we structure our days, all of those things can affect us, taking time to breathe, and we start to adopt those things, then we become more open to understanding how a small mental health challenge might be exacerbated if we don't have some of those things in our lives. And so now we might be going down a path more towards a depression or more severe anxiety, but doing it in a way that's not big and scary, but in a way that invites us all to be practicing self-care.
Can they be outside of Santa Barbara County? Since it's virtual, seems to me maybe it's easier to open up.
Anybody can join, and everything, of course, has been aimed at Santa Barbara County because that's where we started. But I love the fact that because things are virtual now, it makes it so much easier.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm joined by Rachel Steidel, Executive Director of YouthWell.
And we also saw the Zoom fatigue setting in for everybody, so we took a break for the summer. And now looking at how schools have gotten much more structured for the fall for students, we don't want now this to be a pressure. So we are doing one Sunday a month, the same way we had been doing our parent workshops. And this time what we're doing is we're continuing to aim them towards students seventh grade through college age. But then we're also inviting parents to attend because parents were sneaking on the calls anyway. I do believe it's just as important for parents to learn alongside their students. We're just asking them to take a more passive role when they're on the call so that students can be asking the questions.
And that's a good lead into my next question, which has to do with parents and how they can help young people or how they can start to look for signs of depression or anxiety in their child and what they can do if they start recognizing some of those signs.
One of the projects that YouthWell has been partnering on is in collaboration with two other organizations in Santa Barbara, the Mental Wellness Center and the Family Service Agency. And it's to provide youth mental health first aid training. And it's one of the best things that I can recommend to parents, educators, and providers, because it gives everybody the same verbiage. It equips family members and caregivers with the skills and knowledge to identify, understand, and respond to the signs or risk factors of mental illness. We're now offering it monthly. It's also moved to a virtual format. But it's been really exciting. We trained last year, we trained the entire, all the districts in Santa Ynez Valley, all the teachers. And when you see a whole community to come together to learn, it's amazing because you also see people start sharing and realizing how many people are affected. Often people are so private that we assume everybody else, especially with social media, right? That everybody else's lives are so much better and look so ideal. But when you do these workshops and you start hearing people share their experiences and you start to realize, wow, we're all in this together. We all need to be growing from this. And so what I encourage parents to do is, especially when we can't get supports to our kids right away, is to both be practicing self-care for yourself, because it's really easy as parents to make that a last priority. And again, you know, as a mom, I've had to remind myself that constantly, that I'm role modeling to my daughters. And also to look for support groups in your community. I think there's something really amazing when you get to come alongside other parents.
Your efforts are to catch this before it becomes a crisis. But what if a parent feels like their child is in crisis?
There is a safety hotline for Santa Barbara County, and that number is 888-334-2777. There is a SLO hotline, and that number is 800-783-0607. Both of those are great numbers for calling if you're in crisis. And of course, you can always call 911. What can be really great about the hotlines, though, is that they can talk you through to help you really understand what is the next step that you should take. Another number that is great for youth to know about is a texting line called 741-741. And because students often are more comfortable being on their phones and texting, this is a national texting line where they can get support and talk through something, and they will also get reconnected back into their community with resources.
Okay, so tell our listeners how they can get involved, maybe join in on some of these workshops or the mental health first aid training, that kind of thing.
We would love to invite anyone to attend any of our workshops. If you go to youthwell.org, the workshop schedule is listed for the year. And again, parents, teens, caregivers, educators, providers are all invited to attend. The topics change each month.
In closing, do you have any advice for parents or the young people at home right now?
Again, I just think listening and remember to breathe. Practice wellness breaths because they really work and there's something we can do all day long.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Rachel Steidel from YouthWell in Santa Barbara. This is Beth Thornton.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be hearing the nonprofit story. Today, KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes will be talking with Chenda Lohr from the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. The San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden is in El Choro Regional Park, halfway between San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay on Highway 1. Friends of the SLO Botanical Garden is a nonprofit organization which has a lease for the 150-acre site from the San Luis Obispo County Parks Department. KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes talks with the Botanical Garden's Chenda Lohr.
Welcome to another episode of The Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes. With me today is Chenda Lohr, the Executive Director of the Gardens. Why don't you start off by just giving us a little bit of background and history of the Botanical Gardens?
Okay, so the Botanical Garden started over 30 years ago as a Cal Poly senior project done by Eve V. Hill. Mm-hmm. And she is a horticulture major back in the day. She was studying xeriscaping, which is landscaping with very little water to no water, studying Mediterranean climate zone plants. And she approached her advisor and said, we don't have a botanical garden here. Somebody should start one. And he says, you should start one, Eve. And then this is where we are today, 150 acres across the street from Cuesta College on El Choro Regional Park land. We occupy the 150 acres of the 720 acres of El Choro Regional Park. The County Board of Supervisors just this March approved our operating agreement with County Parks to secure the land for the garden for another 100 years. Right now we have currently a preview garden, a fire safe garden, a discovery trail that's a 3.25 mile loop trail that goes around the land. And we have a children's garden that is fantastically inviting and children love it. We also have a sage meadow that they love to play with and in and imagine. We have a restoration garden that's being put in currently. That's about 2 acres of indigenous weaving garden and herb garden that'll also serve as another outdoor classroom. We have started designs for a 3-mile loop that goes around the garden's 150 acres, taking us across the creeks and through chaparral and grassland and Oakland Meadow and Oakland Forest, and it's going to be fantastic. So now we have a 501c3 organization operated by the Friends of the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden. I started as their executive director. It'll be 2 years in December.
Great. So
it's not that long ago, but we've accomplished much. We've got an amazing building here that is built to gold LEED standards. It's made out of hay bale, designed by Ken Haggard and Polly Cooper of the Sustainability Group, also in collaboration with Cal Poly and Cuesta College. Actually, Cuesta College used this building as their classroom for 3 years. They built the structure. Cal Poly engineers designed our wastewater treatment system. We operate on solar. We have a rainwater collection system that was designed by a volunteer engineer and is being worked on currently to expand our storage capacity. So lots going on here. We invite innovative building designs and construction for our future gardens. We have information kiosks designed by Reese Designs and engineered by Taylor & Siphon. They engineered the kiosk that is almost ready to go to permit. So it'll be exciting. They'll serve as education, shade, structures, and a focal point to our islands of signature landscapes for each Mediterranean climate zone that we have here at the garden. So if you're not familiar, the Mediterranean climate zone is characterized by a short rainy season, about 5 months, and 7 months of dry, not much rain at all, an average of about 20 inches of rainfall per year. So, and California, and of course the Central Coast, is one of the Mediterranean climate zones. And the other ones are Australia, South Africa, areas of Chile, and the Mediterranean Basin, of course.
So actually, it sounds like a garden that is competitive with anything around the world.
I would definitely say the same, but I am kind of biased. It is a unique garden because we do focus on the Mediterranean climate zone, and that which is a unique climate zone characteristic. So only certain types of plants grow here. We have some rare Dahlias, lots of different types of succulents, and California native plants, of course, and lots of unique oak trees, eucalyptus, and plants that are only able to grow in the, 2% of the world's land mass has this same Mediterranean climate characteristic. So it's a rare climate zone when you think about the whole big picture of the world. Mm-hmm. We have a very unique system here.
So I know that you had to be sheltered and closed for a period of time with the COVID-19, but you're open now, correct, for the public?
Yes, we are open. And so we're open whenever there's daylight. El Chorro Regional Park opens our gates, and we are open from sunup to sundown every day of the week. Just come and turn the Purple Bridge. We do ask for a $5 entrance fee, which is totally on the honor system. So it's very, very accessible to everyone.
And wearing masks out there right now?
Yes. Yeah. We'll follow the same guidelines as any park would. There's plenty of space to spread out, so the socially distancing is very available here at the garden. What makes this a botanical garden and not just any beautiful garden is our education base.
Okay.
We accessed in our plants, mm-hmm. so that means we catalog them, so we're like a plant library. Mm-hmm. We have QR codes on a lot of our plants that you can click on, use your smartphone and zap the QR code, and you'll learn the history of the plant, what it's called, how long it's been there, its characteristics, and all sorts of fun facts about the plants here at the garden.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes and Chenda Lore of the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden.
Are there educational tours, docent-led tours?
Right. Docent-led tours are available to anybody who wants to call us and make an appointment so we can set up the docent. All of our docents are volunteers, so we do ask for donations for the tours, and they can be done any day of the week, and depending on your schedule. We also offer monthly garden founder walks and talks with Eve Vigil. You get to meet her in person. She's an amazing ball of energy. If you've ever been around Eve, you know that you have, because she's just leaves a major imprint of just happiness and energy. We also have weekly meditation classes here, outside, of course. We also will be offering art classes in the afternoons to supplement for the virtual education system that's going on locally here in San Luis Obispo. Dara Rosenweiser is teaching a smartphone photography class. Don also leads a monthly full moon ceremony and renewal rituals at the garden. Some of our fundraisers that are coming up, since we can't have in-person events, we're having virtual silent auctions to, you can have access to that on our website at slobg.org. And we also have a takeaway dinner. For those of you who are local, I know Jose Dehan, very famous chef, amazing French food. He's volunteering to cook for us, and you can come pick up a takeaway dinner on October 3rd, and you can order your dinner online at our website. Art in the Garden last year was a huge success. This year, instead, we are pivoting to offer retail space for the arts to include lots of amazing local art.
When is that going to be?
I have not set the dates yet, but it'll definitely be include November.
You have so much going on, and I know you have so many growth areas too. Mm-hmm. I think that you still need a lot of support from the community, being a nonprofit, and we're going through some interesting times. You're doing a lot of shifting. Yeah. Are there any things that the general public can help you with?
Oh, we love donations. We really need the public support. to continue. I know that donations across the board have dropped about 50% for nonprofits, and that's really painful, especially when you're not an essential service. Mm. Our operations is not deemed essential, but we are open and our grounds still need to be maintained. So I feel like we are essential for mental health and physical health. I know our volunteer and garden community is, you know, hundreds, thousands of people wide. So we are sustained by our volunteers, and our volunteer community that comes out here on a regular basis is over 100, 150 people that log hours on a regular basis to help us maintain our grounds. Visitors come out, and we estimate 30 to 50,000 people come out to see the garden and walk our trails and to learn about the plants here and to just enjoy the fresh air and participate in programs. We're also offering virtual tours for people that don't want to leave their homes or aren't able to. We have a YouTube channel, actually, you can go on. If you just type in San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden YouTube, you'll get onto our YouTube channel and see a lot of videos of Eve and Ken Levine, who's one of our amazing docents who's been here for over 30 years. They lead tours of different parts of our gardens, education tours. We're working on an adventure tours of our trails. So you get to see a sneak peek of all the vistas and areas of interest. There's a great spot for geology.
You have so much going on. I think this is probably a lot of new information for the people that are listening. They may have driven past the garden on Highway 1 several times, but not turned in. And so hopefully they will turn in and visit. Please tell everybody how they can get to your website.
Yeah, visit slobg.org. See what we have to offer, everything. Our schedule, our calendar is there. You can also volunteer at the garden. Just fill out the form. You don't have to be a gardener to volunteer at the garden. We have a gift shop, a full retail nursery. We need administrative help, and we always need people to advocate for the garden.
Definitely go and look for the takeaway dinner, and also find ways to support the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden, which definitely puts our community on the map. Talking with Chinda Lohr, she is the executive director of the SLO Botanical Garden, and this is Dr. Consuelo Mutz with the Nonprofit Story.
You've just heard a conversation between KCBX contributor Consuelo Mutz and Chinda Lohr of the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden. And finally, earlier this month, over 150 hikers and backpackers had to be rescued from the High Sierra by helicopter due to the creek fire. What was it like to be stranded in the wilderness by a raging wildfire? KVPR's Laura Sitsui spoke to some of those who waited it out at a rustic resort deep in the Sierra National Forest.
When James Wade Sponsler and two friends set out on a backpacking trip Friday night over Labor Day weekend, they didn't know a fire had started 30 miles away.
Just about lunchtime on Saturdays, when we noticed a massive thunderhead, unbeknownst to us, this was actually the fire itself.
The three have been hiking portions of the 214-mile-long John Muir Trail over the last few years, and this was the first time they'd hit the trail together all summer. Last year, they hiked through a downpour, so they were ready to push through what looked like more rain. They arrived at Rosemary Meadow right on schedule Saturday night and set up camp. Sunday morning, they woke up to smoke.
The best way of describing it is like fog. It was smoke, and we never, ever, ever saw fire. All we saw was smoke.
That's Albert Yergel, one of Sponsler's backpacking buddies. They met, by the way, through Boy Scouts.
So I checked my spot communication device, which is a satellite pager, and my wife is trying to contact me. Without even reading it, I went, oh,
He knew there was a serious problem. Her message? The forest was on fire. Instead of taking 2 days to finish the hike as planned, the group covered 13 miles in 1 day, hoping they could get home before the fire got any worse. But once they returned to their cars...
And there's a note on there from the ranger saying the road closed at 4 o'clock.
Their cars were at Vermilion Valley Resort on Lake Edison, so they decided to settle in. Other hikers and backpackers stranded by the blaze joined them. The resort was a rendezvous point, not in the path of the Creek Fire at the time, so they were safe. Riley Budd, a third member of Sponsor's crew, says waiting for the helicopters wasn't the most stressful part of being stranded at the resort.
As soon as we got into VVR on Sunday night, after that long day of hiking, several people were running around the campsite because a man had passed unconscious.
Bud is CPR certified, so he went to help.
And that was one of the most overwhelming experiences I've had in my life. I was very focused in the moment and wasn't freaking out or anything while I was doing CPR. Right after, I was very overwhelmed.
The man Bud tried to revive passed away. On Monday, the three filled in for the resort's kitchen staff. There was a skeleton crew working because of the fire. For dinner, Sponsler and his friends went way beyond trail mix. They prepared tri-tip, risotto, and roasted pan-seared bacon garlic green beans.
We ate really good for being in an evacuation camp.
By dinner time, the group had also made a roster of everyone there and started mapping a route out should they have to hike away from the fire to the eastern side of the Sierra. It would be a 20-plus mile trek. Sponsler says having things to do kept him calm, but no hike was necessary. On Tuesday morning, just after 3 a.m., the smoke cleared enough for helicopters to land at Lake Edison and bring them back to Fresno. In retrospect, Sponsler says it felt right that they were there.
It's appropriate that it happened the week of 9/11. It kind of gave me that sense that, you know, where people came together again in a time where we're more fractured than we ever have been today.
Even with that optimism, though, Sponsler says he's done with 2020.
I wrote in the ash on the back of my car, 2020 can suck it. And that's exactly what it says.
Riley Budd agrees.
Here we all were trying to get away from the hustle and bustle of daily life and try to get a little break from all the stuff that's been going on in 2020, only for the year to hit us once again with a solid uppercut.
However, Albert Yergel says, in a way, it was the best kind of adventure.
We never, ever were in any danger, except when Wade almost got bit by a rattlesnake, but that doesn't count.
The three say they're still planning to finish hiking the John Muir Trail. They have two segments left. They say they'll hike them as early as possible in 2021. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.